Okay, this is Victor Cunicelli of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission. Today's date is October 14, 2010. The time is approximately 1 a.m. Eastern Standard. I'm accompanied by various members of the Financial Crisis Inquiry Commission and witness Tony Peterson via telephone. We're at the headquarters of the FCIC for the interview of Mr. Peterson. This interview will be recorded with the consent of Mr. Peterson. Mr. Peterson, could I get your verbal assent for the record?
Yes.
Okay. Will everyone please state your full name and affiliation for the record, and please spell your last name for the transcriptionist. Mr. Peterson, I'll bring you guys in. We'll identify ourselves around the table first. Cunicelli is C-U-N-I-C-E-L-L-I, and I'm with FCIC.
Tom Borges, that's B as in boy, O-R-G-E-R-S, with the FCIC.
Tom Krebs, K-R-E-B-S, with the FCIC.
Bob Hinckley, H-I-N-K-L-E-Y, with the FCIC.
John Armstrong, A-R-M-S-T-R-O-N-G, FCIC.
Okay, Mr. Peterson, why don't you start and go around in turn there?
Tony Peterson, P-E-T-E-R-S-O-N, Saxon Mortgage Services.
Raul Yanes, Y-A-N-E-S, Davis Polk & Wardwell.
William Fenrich, F as in Frank, E-N-R-I-C-H, also of Davis Polk.
Carissa Pilati, P as in Peter, I-L-O-T-T-I, Davis Polk.
And Corin Swift. Corin is C-O-R-I-N, Swift, S-W-I-F-T, Bingham, McCutcheon.
Okay. In the way of background, the FCIC was established by statute, Public Law 111-21, and signed into law by the President. It is bipartisan and consists of 10 commissioners. It is charged with examining the causes of the financial crisis and collapse or near collapse of major domestic financial institutions. The commission is charged with composing a report of findings to the President and Congress by December 15, 2010. The commission may compel attendance and testimony of witnesses and production of records. I could provide you a copy of the statute, Mr. Peterson, by which the commission was formed if you so desire, and you could simply make that desire through counsel known to me, and I'll be more than happy to pass that along. Please be advised that the FCIC is an agency of the United States and that FCIC staff are federal employees under the aegis of 18 United States Code Section 1001 concerning false statements. So that we get a quality transcript, sir, a couple of housekeeping things. If just make sure that all your responses are verbal and audible. And I believe the Davis Polk attorneys had a matter they wanted to bring up regarding confidentiality.
Yeah, thank you. It's just we're going to assert the same confidentiality protections we did for the Tom Whiff interview. And you've got the commission has a letter on file from us about that. And we'll send you a follow-up to cover this one if necessary.
Okay, that's fantastic, and I would caution the witness that the FCIC proceedings, we ask for confidentiality outside, of course, with him consulting counsel. Mr. Borges has a point that he wanted to bring up.
Yeah, we have one major housekeeping thing that we'd like to address, and that's just for our June 23rd request, we received very little information from you all, and could you get back to us later today with what the status is of that?
Yeah, actually, I can tell you right now, it's on the half-yard line, so it's imminent, and we were hoping to get it as soon as this week, but if not this week, then certainly early next week.
Is that Raul?
Yeah, this is Raul.
Tom Krebs, Raul.
Hey,
to the extent that you're sending us put-back data, if you can, we want you to aggregate it. I don't want individual stuff. If you can aggregate it and break it down by the reasons why they were put back, it'll make things a lot simpler, and I think it'll simplify your task as well.
And this is Tom Borges. I'll send you a chart that all the banks have been complying with, and it's real simple for your analysts to kind of put in seven different categories.
Okay.
And what we intend to do with that, Raul, is to aggregate the data for the banks with respect to putbacks. We also are requesting you give us your top five by number or dollar volume, and we're going to report that as a combined number, and we will request that the commission put a five-year embargo on that data.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Peterson, if we could we get a biographical background from you? Why don't you start with your educational background, college, and your professional background?
Certainly. I completed 1 year of college at the University of Texas in San Antonio. That was ending in the spring of 1985. I began my professional career in January of 1986 at Pacific Thrift and Loan. They were a small bank in Southern California. I worked there for approximately 14 years. My responsibilities there were to manage all of default servicing, which included functions such as collection, foreclosure, bankruptcy, loss mitigation, title claims. After leaving Pacific Thrift and Loan in, I believe, January of 2000, I took on a similar role at Life Bank, also in Southern California. I worked there from approximately March of 2000 through September of 2001. After leaving Life Bank, I went to work for Clayton Services in February of 2002. I worked there initially as a contract diligence underwriter. After approximately 6 months, I became a project lead with Clayton, leading diligence projects for various clients of theirs. I worked at Clayton for approximately a year and a half. Then I went to work for Morgan Stanley in June of 2003, initially as a consultant, as a due diligence manager. I worked in the consultant capacity for 1 year and then became a permanent employee in June of 2004, still as a due diligence manager. I believe it was near the end of 2005, I was promoted to the title of vice president. Initially, when I went to work at Morgan Stanley, I was managing due diligence on scratch and dent loan acquisitions. In the second half of 2005, I also became responsible for managing due diligence on our subprime bulk acquisitions and also our prime and Alt-A bulk acquisitions. I continued with Morgan Stanley. When they bought Saxon Mortgage Services, my function was transferred into the Saxon Corporation. I'm still employed at Saxon as a vice president of due diligence.
Mr. Peterson, during the period from 2005 to 2007, can you tell us how your role as vice president due diligence, how that fit into the Morgan Stanley organization chart in other words, who did you report to? How many people reported to you? And what part of Morgan Stanley was this all in?
During that time period, I reported to Pamela Barrow. She was also a vice president. I don't recall the exact name of the business unit within Morgan Stanley that we were a part of. On a larger scale, it was part of the fixed income business division. And the number of people that reported to me varied over time during from 2005 to 2007. Anywhere from two or three up to six or seven people reported to me during that time period.
And would it have been fewer people at the beginning and more people near 2007?
I think generally it did grow over time during that period. In late 2005, when I was asked to head up diligence over the subprime mortgage acquisitions, my direct reports did increase at that time, and I think it may have grown a little bit through 2006 as well.
And Pamela Barra, she was your superior. What was her role in Morgan Stanley?
She was my supervisor, overseeing the due diligence for the bulk acquisition process that we were a part of. And she also had some responsibilities for the conduit business through which Morgan Stanley was purchasing loans on a flow basis. And I don't recall if she may have some responsibilities in other areas as well.
So essentially, she was the person in charge overall of all due diligence?
I think she and I think her immediate supervisor also had a lot of responsibility over the area of due diligence.
And who was her immediate supervisor?
That was Terry Smith.
And what was Terry Smith's function besides due diligence?
He also had responsibility over the conduit business. For approximately 4 years, I worked in their Florida office in Boca Raton, and he managed that entire office.
You say you worked in Boca Raton for 4 years? What years were they?
That was from the summer of 2004 through the summer of 2008.
So you were based in Florida during this period?
Yes, I was.
Are you still based in Florida?
No, when they transferred our function into the Saxon Corporation, some of us moved to work in the Irving, Texas office approximately just over 2 years ago.
Okay. Where was Mr. Smith based? He was based in Boca.
He was, yes, for that time period as well.
As was Pamela Barra.
Correct.
And was this strictly a due diligence operation in Florida?
My recollection is that's where due diligence management was located. They also operated a conduit business there in that office.
Explain what a conduit business is, if you would.
My understanding of a conduit business is it's buying closed loans on a flow basis. Compared to the business line I worked in, we were buying pools of loans rather than individual loans on a flow basis.
Okay, and but due diligence with regard to bulk acquisition for all of Morgan Stanley was based in Boca Raton, is that right?
Well, I don't know that I could say it was for all of Morgan Stanley. My understanding is that's where due diligence for the United States residential mortgage business was based.
All right. And did Pamela Barra have other people that reported to her besides you? Not including people below you, of course?
Yes, I believe she did.
And what were those, what was their function?
Well, I'll do my best to try and recall that information. I think it changed from time to time.
Yeah, we're trying to set the stage here. I'm trying to understand how the whole system works. So if you could help me out rather than make me ask a whole bunch of 21 questions, that we can cut this short.
And I'll certainly do my best. To my recollection, for a period of time, Brad Davis reported to her, and he managed the valuation process for our residential mortgage business. I believe there was at least one or two people in the conduit business that reported to her. I think for a period of time, at least one or two people who managed the cure and repurchase process reported to her as well.
Okay, great. Now, you said that you had two or three at the beginning, and maybe as many as six or seven at one time, people working for you. What did these people do?
The folks that reported to me were due diligence managers, and their primary purpose or function was to work on specific loan acquisition due diligence projects.
Okay. Why don't you take me through a typical day for you and the people that work for you? How does the system work?
Well, I think it might be easier to walk through a due diligence project rather than a typical day, because the days had some variance depending on where we were on a particular project. Would that be more helpful?
Could be. Sounds like a good idea. Go ahead.
Okay. Our process was to work with the entire business team when we became aware that a trade had been entered into.
When you say the entire business team, who are you talking about?
I'm talking about the business unit that was buying these pools of mortgage loans. So there was a trade desk in New York. There was a team called Contract Finance, also in New York, a group to do collateral analysis, which was a lot of data analysis, also based in New York. And then we had our due diligence team. I was based in Florida. I had due diligence managers that lived in various parts of the country, some of them in Florida. And then we also had the valuations group that worked on our business as well. So when we became... I'm sorry, go
ahead. Go ahead with your story about how the due diligence system worked.
So when we became aware that a trade had been entered into, we would receive information regarding the timelines for the trade and the due diligence review. We would be made aware of the number of loans to be selected in the due diligence sample. We would coordinate with our vendors for credit and compliance. That was primarily Clayton. Organize the logistics of where and when the project would start, make sure that there was enough resources to work on the project. One of our diligence managers would be on site with the vendor's team. The vendor would work in our area specifically on a credit re-underwrite and a compliance review. So information would be sent to the vendor and to the seller so they could have the files ready for the due diligence sample. Clayton would review each of those loan files and perform a credit re-underwrite to compare the loans against the lender's guidelines and also look for specific risk issues that may exist within those loans. They would also test those loans for regulatory compliance, all applicable federal, state, and local mortgage lending laws. Any loans in which they found exceptions to either missing documents or guideline exceptions or any other risk issues associated with the loan, they would grade those accordingly. Most of those were elevated to our team of due diligence managers to take a look at. If it was something simple such as just a missing document, our team did not need to look at that file. That would go straight to the seller, so they would have an opportunity to try and locate that document and provide that response. The other risk issues our team would look at, make a decision on is the overall characteristics and risk of the loan within an acceptable risk or is it not within our tolerance. They could choose to waive that exception and keep the loan, or if not, they would refer that loan over to the seller with the information about what the concerns or exceptions were. The seller would have an opportunity to review that and provide any additional information or a rebuttal that our team would then take another look at and make a final determination on the loan. Typically, this process on a trade lasted for 2 to 3 weeks. It was very iterative as loans were reviewed. Anything that the seller needed to see would be looked at. Once the process was complete, our final results would then be sent back to the team in New York, the trade desk and contract finance and collateral analysis, so they could aggregate that information with all their other sources of information for the trade and then finalize that trade.
All right. Let's go back to the beginning. Were you involved at all in negotiation or bidding with regard to the acquisition of the loans, or was that all done by people in New York?
I was not involved in that. It's my understanding that the trade desk had the primary responsibility for negotiating the actual purchase of the loans.
So they dealt face-to-face with the seller or by phone with the seller or email or what? They were the direct contact with the seller.
It's my understanding that they did have direct contact with the seller regarding the purchase of the loans, yes.
Okay, and you weren't involved, your people weren't involved at all. Now, am I correct in assuming that were you giving the entire loan pool to do due diligence, or were you given a portion of it?
It was typically a sample, a portion of the pool that would be put through the credit and compliance due diligence process.
Who determined the sample? Were that people in New York, or did you do it?
That would be people in New York.
To your knowledge, was there any negotiation of the size of that sample?
Not to my knowledge.
You never saw confirmations limiting the amount of due diligence that could be done on a particular loan pool?
I don't recall seeing anything like that, no.
Did you ever see the contracts that pursuant to which the loans were bought?
I may have reviewed portions of contracts at times. I don't have a specific recollection.
If you did, it was infrequently.
Correct.
So your group, or you in Florida, get a loan pool to review. How many loan pools did you get a week to review, would you say?
It wasn't really on a weekly basis. A trade process, including diligence, usually lasted about a month. And the number of trades per month varied over time. In our subprime business, it in some months it might have been two or three trades, in other months it might have been six or seven trades.
Okay, and you were responsible for, refresh my recollection, subprime as well as Alt-A.
That's correct.
So were you including Alt-A in those numbers or not?
That was just subprime, including Alt-A. The number of trades may have varied from four or five per month up to 10 or 12 per month.
And the typical trade would include how many loans?
There was a great deal of variance in the size of the loan pools.
From what to what?
I would say from 300 or 400 loans up to 8,000 or 9,000 loans.
And what determined that size usually? Were there particular originators that did more business, therefore had bigger pools, or how did it happen?
That would be my best guess, is different originators or aggregators had differing volumes of loans available in the secondary market.
Did you notice any patterns in terms of where these loans were, where the big pools were coming from and the littler pools were coming from?
Not that I can recall.
Who were some of the originators you were buying loans from?
In our subprime business, I can recall purchasing loans from Decision One, from New Century, from WMC, from Accredited. I think there was a few others. I just don't recall all of the names right. In our prime and Alt-A business, there was various banks that we would buy pools of loans from.
Would they be smaller pools or bigger pools in the subprime?
Are you asking, were the Alt-A pools bigger than the subprime?
Or vice versa?
I think on average they may have been a little bit smaller.
Okay. That is, the Alt-A might be a little bit smaller?
Correct.
Okay. When you were giving the loan tape with the sample in it, then you must have communicated directly with the seller, is that right?
We did have communications directly with the seller to coordinate the due diligence logistics, yes.
And that probably became a matter of routine over time, at least with regard to your regular customers.
Yes, the process became well known at some of the originators where we bought loans on a regular basis.
Were the reviews normally done At Clayton's offices, or were they done on-site?
For the majority of that time, from 2005 through 2007, they were done at the seller's site. Towards the end of that time period, there was a little bit of a shift, and some of the reviews started to be done at Clayton's office. This occurred when some of the originators developed better imaging capabilities.
Okay. And you said that some of the people you worked for were based around the country. Well, I assume they were based somewhere near some of your bigger clients, but could you tell me where?
Yeah, but was it people you worked for or people who reported to you?
People who reported to you.
People who reported to me, yeah. A few of them lived in Southern California during that time period. I think one or two live somewhere in the Mid-East Coast. I don't remember exactly.
And they would get on a plane at any time and head off to the originator's offices to supervise due diligence?
Correct. Travel where needed to be there and work on that specific project.
And they were responsible for the day-to-day operation. How often did they raise things with you?
It varied depending on what they were coming across in their review. I typically communicated with each of them several times a week.
And were these people busy 100% of the time? Were they contract or were they employees of Morgan Stanley?
The people that reported directly to me were employees hired as a consulting basis through a company called Equinox.
Is Equinox a subsidiary of Morgan Stanley or is it a separate company?
To my understanding, it is a separate company.
Okay, so just make sure I got this right. Essentially, you were the vice president in charge of due diligence, and you farmed out the due diligence to Clayton, and that due diligence was overseen by Equinox.
We did hire Clayton as a vendor. Morgan Stanley used Equinox as a staffing service to hire consultants that were working as full-time employees for Morgan Stanley.
But they were employees of Equinox?
They were paid through Equinox. They were hired directly by Morgan Stanley to work for Morgan Stanley.
They were seconded to Morgan Stanley?
I think that would be a good description, yes.
All right. Can you give me the name of a few of these people? Maybe one from Southern California and one from someplace in the Mideast, Mideastern United States?
Rob Travis was one who lived in Southern California during that time. And for at least part of that time, Frank Fair, I think, lived in either North or South Carolina. I don't remember for sure.
Do you know if these people, when they weren't working for Morgan Stanley, worked for other securitizers?
No, these people during this time period worked only for us.
Only for you, okay.
They were our full-time employees on a consulting basis.
So tell me how they would typically, how would they interact with you on a, what would you say was on a daily basis?
In some cases, I think typically I communicated with each of them several times per week.
Mm-hmm.
By telephone or email. I would also go to the job sites from time to time and be there with them at various projects.
And what things would come up in conversation between you and them?
We would talk about how the project was coming along, the status of their review. They would let me know if they were having any particular difficulties with the flow of files from the seller, or if they were seeing any particular type of exceptions, if there were any matters where they had an exception that the seller disagreed with, and the seller wanted somebody else to take a second look at it, I would participate in that process.
And this happens several times per week, basically?
Various conversations happen several times per week, yes.
Did you have any idea of the size of the sample you were given in terms of a percentage of the total loan pool?
I did have a general sense of what our sampling percentages were, yes.
And do you want to tell me what that was?
In our subprime business, the sampling percentages ranged from 25% up to 100%.
And what would determine whether it was 25%, and what would determine whether it was what would 25, and which would what would determine if it was 100?
Generally speaking, if we were entering into a trading partnership with a seller for the first time, we would sample higher, usually at 100% on the first couple of trades, and then if results came in a good way, we would work with that client in conjunction with the team in New York to lower the sample over a period of time. And so the sample percentage was based on our experience with that client, how long we had been doing business with them. And in some cases, some of the sellers asked us to keep the sampling at a higher percentage because they would use that as part of their own internal QC process.
That's unusual.
There weren't many who did that, but there was one or two that I can recall.
Which two?
I think decision one had us keep sampling at above 50%, and I can't remember. There may have been one other, but I don't remember for sure who it was.
And so would it be more common that you were sampling 25%?
I think the common range was 25 to 45%.
But generally, you didn't know what the percentage was, did you?
I think over time, to my recollection, I had developed an understanding of what percentages we were sampling at the various sellers.
But you weren't responsible for choosing the samples, as he said before.
Correct. As we said, I was not involved in selecting the sample or in determining what percentage we would sample.
And, okay, so let's go through now the reports you're getting back from Clayton. Tell me how they reported to you, what the system was, if you would.
Well, our diligence managers on each project would receive various reports. Some of them they would look at daily. Some of them they would look at a couple of times a week. The primary reports they looked at had to do with identifying the loans that had been reviewed to that point, any exceptions that Clayton had found with those loans, what grade Clayton had applied to the loan based on their credit review and compliance review, as well as all of the comments that Clayton had created as part of their review process. They would also look at production reports. And in the case of the loans with individual exceptions, Clayton would also print out an individual report called an asset summary that contained details about that specific loan that would be in the loan file that our team would also look at in reviewing those elevated exceptions and then pass on along to the seller.
Okay, and were you given a report at the end which basically aggregated everything together?
Correct. At the end of the due diligence process, there would be a tie-out with the seller where after this 2 or 3 week period, where loans with exceptions were provided to the seller and they had an opportunity to provide cures and responses. At the last day of the diligence process, a report would be generated that would list all the loans that still had level three exceptions associated with them. Our diligence manager would share that report with their counterpart at the seller, and both sides would confirm that, yes, this is the population of loans that still has level three exceptions. Any last-minute responses that the seller wanted to give would be looked at that meeting if there were any. And then an aggregate report with all of the results for all of the loans would be created and sent back to our team in New York. And then once that tie-out was done, usually a day or two later, Clayton would provide a package of reports by email that would be sent to various people within our business unit. It would come to typically me and the diligence manager, and also to contract finance and collateral analysis.
And what happened then?
That information would be aggregated along with other sources of information regarding that trade. Results would be, to my understanding, also coming in from the value team regarding their process. Data would be coming from the seller regarding the loan data that's required to be provided by them. And I also believe that a report would come from our custodian who would be checking in the collateral files. And to my understanding, collateral would aggregate all of this information and provide it back to the trade desk so they could then tie out the trade and make final determinations on which loans they were going to purchase.
But you don't understand how that process, you understand it generally, but you didn't, you weren't involved in making the decisions at the end as to which loans were purchased and which ones weren't.
That's correct. My team and my process, once we submitted the final tie-out report and verified that Clayton had provided the final reporting package, is where our process ended. And so, no, I was not involved in the remaining part of that process of finalizing the trade.
And neither was Clayton at this point. Clayton's out, right?
To my understanding, that's correct.
And who on the trade desk would make that decision?
In our subprime business, to my memory, the two people that worked on that in that time period were Frank Teleska and Steven Shapiro.
How do you spell Teleska?
T-E-L-E-S-C-A.
Okay, now, so did you ever count up how many loans a month you were looking at? Do you have some sort of a production record at the end of the year that gave you an indication of how many loans your people had reviewed?
I don't recall looking at an annual number. We certainly had the reports from each of the trades that we worked on that detailed the number of loans that were actually reviewed. Now, something to keep in mind that we knew how many loans were in a sample. That doesn't mean that our team looked at all of those loans, because as Clayton reviewed the files, some of the loans had no exceptions and were not reviewed by my team.
Okay, but basically Clayton reviewed everything, right? Everything that was in the sample.
Everything that was in a sample, Clayton would review that. There would maybe be occasions where the seller couldn't produce a file, and so then it was not looked at.
Right. Well, were you responsible for paying Clayton's bills? I don't obviously mean out of pocket, but would their bills have had to have been approved by you?
We did review them for accuracy and then send them up to New York for payment.
So they were paid on a per loan basis?
I believe that that's correct, that they had a per loan fee that they charged for the credit review and the compliance review.
Okay. And you still don't really have any idea of how many loans in a year or a month that they might have looked at?
There was a great deal of variance
Yeah, I mean, if he sits here right now, I think he's saying you can't estimate a number accurately. Is that right, Tony?
I could guesstimate at a range, but I would want to go back and try to give you a real accurate answer.
How about giving me a range?
I would say in our subprime business that the number of loans that Clayton reviewed for us per month probably ranged anywhere from 1,000 to 5,000.
All right.
Maybe a little bit more than 5,000 in some months.
So there was a wide range.
There was a wide range. It depended on the number and volume of trades in a given month.
Is it safe to say that in 2007 you were doing probably more than you were in 2004?
I think that's probably a safe assumption.
Okay. And you limited yourself to subprime. How about Alt-A?
To my recollection, the volume in Alt-A was less than the volume in subprime. Clayton wasn't the only vendor we used. There was a couple other vendors we used at times in our Alt-A business. Trying to guesstimate at a range of loans that vendors reviewed for us in Alt-A would have been anywhere from a couple hundred per month to maybe a couple thousand per month.
Okay. What's the difference in due diligence procedures for Alt-A and subprime?
For our credit and compliance review, there's no real difference in procedures. A sample would be selected, and for the work we did, those loans would go through a credit re-underwrite and a compliance review.
You had a question, Tom?
This is Tom Krebs, Mr. Peterson. I'm looking at a document from Clayton that says from the first quarter of 06 through the second quarter of 07, Clayton Holdings reviewed 62,940 loans for Morgan Stanley. Does that comport with your understanding?
Could you repeat those date ranges to me again?
First quarter of 06 through the second quarter of 07, 62,940 loans were reviewed.
That could be correct.
In addition, it says that of those loans, 39,786 were determined to be event 1 and 2 loans. Have y'all covered 2?
No.
What are event 1 and 2 loans?
An event 1 loan would be a loan that Clayton has determined have no exceptions associated with it as they reviewed the file. An event 2 loan would be something that Clayton has determined has a minor exception but is still acceptable.
What was an event 3 loan?
An event 3 loan would be something where Clayton has either determined on their own review that they've identified an exception, or there's an exception, they've identified a risk issue in there that their client, meaning us, has asked them to look for and elevate to our attention.
So an event 3 was merely bring to our attention, is that your understanding?
It was bring to our attention, yes. Or either they found what they considered to be something more than a minor exception, or it was something that we had instructed them that they were not allowed to make the subjective decision on, and they had to elevate to our attention.
Do I understand that Morgan Stanley superimposed over the underwriter's guidelines additional requirements for loans?
Yes, we did ask of Clayton and require them to look for risk issues that may exist within the loans that were not accounted for in the guidelines. And in addition to that, We gave Clayton limited authority to make a loan a level 2. There were some minor defined exceptions that we would allow them to make the subjective risk decisions on. But for the most part, if they found an exception to the guidelines or a loan with maybe more than one exception, rather than empowering them to make it a 2
we required them to make it at 3 so that our team could look at it and make those risk decisions.
Give me an example, if you will, of some of the overlays or additional restrictions that you placed on Clayton.
Certainly. One example that would relate to limited discretion on level 2 findings would be Clayton might review a loan and determine that the loan-to-value ratio exceeds the guideline for that particular loan. And for example, if the guideline limit is 80% and Clayton determines that the loan-to-value is really 83%, but they see other features about the loan that in their own judgment make the loan still a reasonable mortgage loan risk, they could make that a level 2. If that loan-to-value exception exceeded 5% of the guidelines, meaning they could approve it up to 85, but if it hit 86, they needed to make that a 3. In most cases, there's not a material difference between 85 and 86 LTV, but that's just an example of where we set limits for their risk decisioning authority, and we required them to make that a level 3 exception.
And the reason for doing that is because, was it your operation or was it the trade desk that wanted to make the decision with respect to all event 3s to determine whether or not they were possible 2Ws? You familiar with the term 2W?
Yes, I am.
Okay. Who made the decision about turning a 3 into a 2W?
That would be our team of diligence managers.
So your folks and the traders were not involved in that?
That's correct. During the diligence process, if Clayton elevated something as a 3, regardless of the reason, our team, again, except for the documentation exceptions that the seller could try to fix, our team would take a look at that, and at their first review of the issue and the overall loan, they could make a decision at that point that it was acceptable and change the grade to a 2W. Or if they weren't comfortable with the loan, they would leave it as a 3. And if the seller came back with some additional information that upon review we decided was acceptable, we could make it a 2W at that point. And then when our process was complete, we sent the reports up to New York indicating which loans were still a 3, which loans we had changed to a 2W. And then that was the end of our diligence process.
Where did you get your authority to make a 3 a 2W? How did that system work? Did you discuss it with people in New York?
Typically, no. The whole business approach to managing risk, and the reason we manage Clayton so closely is we wanted our team of diligence managers making these subjective risk decisions. And so Morgan Stanley hired very experienced people. We worked closely with them. We had our team of diligence managers that I've already described. And it was through ongoing discussions of what the market was like and what risks were all about in mortgage loans and being focused on having a quality product. Avoiding risk in the mortgage loans was why we wanted our team making those decisions. And so it was my boss and her boss who told us, it's your job, meaning speaking to me, it's my job and my team's job to make these risk decisions as they're elevated by Clayton.
When the, are you familiar with how the bid process is begun for a pool of loans?
I have a general understanding of it, although that's never been my direct area of work.
Well, tell us what your general understanding is.
My general understanding is that a seller puts data into a tape. It's often referred to as a data tape or a data file, and it contains loan level data about all of the loans in the pool that they want to sell. And that data is received by a potential buyer. The data is analyzed, and based on reviewing that data, the trader would make a bid indicating here's how much I'm willing to pay for this pool of loans, subject to maybe certain bid stips that they might impose up front, and then knowing that the pool would have to go through the diligence process.
What bid stips are you referring to?
It's my general understanding that a seller can specify that I'm willing to pay this price, but For example, we will not buy loans that have any high-cost features to them or that are contain regulatory compliance violations, or we won't buy loans that exceed a certain debt-to-income ratio. It's up to the bidder to determine what conditions they want to stipulate with their bid.
And the acceptance or rejection of a bid is, if a bid is accepted, then that information is communicated to you?
We're made aware of a trade once a bid has been accepted, yes.
And so what do you receive in your hands indicating the acceptance of a bid?
As I recall, we would generally receive an email with information about the trade, the dates of the start and sort of end date of the trade, so we would understand our timeline for due diligence, the number of loans that would be in the sample.
Anything else? Well, what about underwriting guidelines?
If we didn't already have the underwriting guidelines from that seller, we would get the underwriting guidelines as well. Typically, those guidelines were also available at the job site so that our team and the vendor's team had access to them.
You're familiar with the Clayton Class system, are you not?
I do have some familiarity with that system, yes.
So is it not true that the underwriting guidelines would be set within that class system and they would use that computer system to assist them in the evaluation of their due diligence and the completion of their due diligence?
I'm not aware of their ability to set guidelines, underwriting guidelines, into their system. They certainly did use their system to assist them in their evaluation process. They would collect data from various documents in their review of the loan file, and their system would perform certain calculations for them and allow them to verify characteristics of the loan and then compare them against that lender's underwriting guideline to make sure the loan conformed with the guidelines.
Did you have meetings with the personnel at Clayton generally during the time frame 2005 to 2007?
We did have meetings, yes.
Typically, what was discussed at those meetings? I mean, apart from the immediately pending due diligence review that had to be completed. Let me simplify. Were you provided with Clayton trending reports?
I generally recall seeing trending reports at some point, but I don't have a specific recollection as to when.
Do you recall a trending report that contained an analysis covering the period, the second quarter of 2006 through the fourth quarter of 2006, for your subprime transactions?
I don't have a specific recollection of that, no.
Are you denying that you received such a report?
I'm not denying, I'm just saying I don't have a recollection of it.
Do you have a recollection of a statement contained in such a trending report that says during this period, and again that was quarter two of 06 through quarter four of 06, 64% of the exceptions Clayton identified as material were overturned by Morgan Stanley?
I don't recall seeing a report like that during that time period.
All right. Now, at what point would you superimpose or overlay on top of the underwriting standards any additional criteria determined to be relevant by Morgan Stanley?
That happened on an ongoing basis through direct discussions with Clayton, with their project leads, with their QCers, with their staff that was at the job sites for us.
Was it Morgan Stanley's policy to prefer particular leads from Clayton?
I don't know that we had a written policy on that, but we certainly managed Clayton closely in the sense that we paid attention to the qualifications of their people that worked on our projects.
Well, did you, for example, have as your top-rated preference Susan Calafiore?
I recall that Susan Calafiore worked for us quite often, I believe, on our New Century trades.
And Tara Higginbotham?
I recall her name as well. I don't remember which trade she may have worked on.
What I'm looking at is a client preferred leads, a document from been provided us by Clayton, and it lists six persons that Morgan Stanley preferred? And I'm going to ask you about each of them. Gwen Armando, do you know her?
I do remember Gwen, yes.
Stacy Gibson?
Yes, I remember Stacy.
Will Gilson?
Will Geeson?
Geeson, yeah, yes, that's right.
Will.
Sorry?
I do remember Will, yes.
And Doug Clements?
I do recall that name also.
Why is it that you would prefer those six people?
Generally speaking, we looked for people at Clayton that had the greater depth of experience, and that having worked with them, we gained a comfort level with their abilities. And having put in that review and that work with them to make sure they understood how we wanted them to look at risk, by using people consistently, we were getting better consistency in our diligence review process and quality.
And similarly, there were certain people at Clayton with whom you did not prefer to use.
I believe there may have been instances where we had an experience that was not preferable to us and we chose not to reuse somebody, yes.
Well, Steve Beecher would be one of those, right?
I'm sorry, repeat
Steve
that question.
Beecher, B-E-E-C-H-E-R.
I remember Steve generally, but I don't recall anything specific about him.
How about Jamie Ryder, R-Y-D-E-R?
I don't recall that name either.
Or Jerry Burren?
I remember the name, but I don't remember anything specific.
Is it fair to say that the reason that you preferred these people was, one, that they were knowledgeable about what you wanted and they could deliver a product to you on a relatively quick basis? They didn't have a big learning curve to go through.
Well, quickness really wasn't a factor. We gained a comfort level with them based on their experience and based on their demonstrated ability to do quality work for us.
I'm going to come back to some Clayton documents in a minute, but I want to go back and get a couple of things. When you worked at Pacific Trust and Loan for 14 years, and one of your positions there was title claims, is that correct?
That's correct. That was part of the default servicing that I managed.
What was involved in title claims?
A title claim is a process wherein if a challenge is brought against the validity of a mortgage or the mortgage's lien position, the lender or the servicer who is working on that loan will file a claim with the title insurance company to either pay out under the policy to recoup or to defend an action if somebody is challenging either the title to the property or the validity of the mortgage lien.
Now, these mortgages for Pacific Thrift and Loan were mortgages that it had issued and held for its own investment?
They were mortgages that it had originated and held. As I recall, they also bought mortgages at times from other companies.
Well, in connection with the purchase of mortgages from other companies, what type of documentation would be required in order to perfect your interest in the title to those mortgages?
When a mortgage is bought, the buyer would typically require an assignment of the mortgage or a transfer of the mortgage in MERS if it is a MERS registered mortgage, and then also an endorsement or a launch to the promissory note.
With respect to MERS, tell us what MERS is. We've obviously been reading a good deal in the newspaper about it here recently.
Yes, I know it's been in the news. My understanding of MERS is it is a computer software system that was designed to eliminate the need for paper assignments of mortgages. Traditionally, when an assignment of mortgage is made upon the sale of a loan, that assignment would get recorded at the county recorder's office.
Yes.
MERS was designed and is used to avoid the need for paper assignments, so that if a mortgage is registered in the MERS system and then that mortgage is sold, the owner of the loan who's selling it can go into the MERS system and transfer the loan to the new owner's name. And then the buyer of the loan can go into the MERS and verify that it's been registered over to their name as the investor who now owns the loan.
Was that essentially the same process that was attempted to be duplicated in connection with your purchase of mortgages in these loan pools?
I'm sorry, I don't follow that question.
Well, I said, was that the same process that was followed in connection with, I mean, to your knowledge, the purchase of the loans in the pools for which you performed due diligence?
Yeah, it's my general understanding that when we would purchase loans, that there would be a verification of either an assignment of the mortgage or a MERS transfer, and also an endorsement or an allonge to the promissory note.
Now, when you say an assignment, to whom was the assignment given?
This is Billy Fenner. I just want to step in. But, Tony, are you describing, with respect to what you're talking about now, the purchase process and the assignments that occur, something that occurs after the due diligence process is complete and Morgan Stanley goes ahead and actually makes a purchase?
I think the timing of it could vary. That's not an area that I'm directly involved in.
Okay.
In the mortgage business, I'm just speaking from a general understanding.
All right, that's fine. I'm more interested in specific knowledge, and perhaps you're not the person to ask about this. Let me ask you a couple of questions that were not asked at the beginning. Have you given testimony or been interviewed by a regulatory agency in any prior case?
Yes, I have.
Before whom? Which agency, or in what instance did you give testimony?
Earlier this year, I gave testimony to the Massachusetts Attorney General,
And that was in connection with that agreement that was entered into between Morgan Stanley and the Mass AG's office, I presume.
That's my understanding. Yes.
Did you ever give any testimony to the SEC or FINRA?
No, I have not.
To your knowledge, are you expected to testify in any case in which Morgan Stanley has been made a defendant in a case involving securitizations?
I'm not aware of any other requests for my testimony at this time.
Okay. You were talking when you spoke about the different...
This might be a good moment to raise it. I think if it's possible, could we just take a short, like, 5-minute break so Tony can stretch his legs and walk?
Sure, sure. I just have one more question. Relating to the prior questions asked. Now, Tony spoke of a valuations group there, and I wondered what that was.
That's not an area that I was working in or responsible over, so I can give you my general understanding of their purpose.
Sure.
And that was to perform a review of sorts of the appraisals regarding the value of the properties that were securing the mortgage loans.
Okay. But what would trigger the request for the valuations group action, if anything?
My understanding is that was a normal part of the process involved in buying a pool of loans.
Do I understand then that when you would look at a particular, and I just want to be certain about this, that when you would buy, or you would be asked to perform due diligence on 25 to 50% to 100% of the loans, that in each of those instances, the valuations group would attempt to come in and verify the valuations of the property or the appraisals for the mortgages?
It's my understanding that they did go through their process on each of the trades. I generally recall that their process ran concurrently with ours, so while we were performing credit and compliance due diligence, they were going through their process to analyze data and identify loans where they would take a closer look at the appraisals. So yes, to my knowledge, it was on every trade.
All right, let's take about a 7 to 10 minute break here, if we may.
All right, so we'll dial back in and 7 to 10 minutes.
You want to take us off the record first?
Yeah, it's I've got 11:03. We'll go off record at this point.